Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Akash Sherman, a visual effects artist making his feature debut as a writer-director with Clara, a drama starring Patrick J. Adams as an astronomer obsessed with finding signs of extraterrestrial life, and Troyan Belisario as the young woman who helps him understand his own place in the universe. The film makes its world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival this afternoon, Monday, September 10th at 5:30 p.m. at the Ryerson Theatre, which is why you're getting this episode a day early. Akash picked the Star Wars saga. Originally, we were going to focus on The Empire Strikes Back, but as you'll hear, the conversation quickly spiraled out beyond Irvin Kershner's 1980 sequel to George Lucas's 1977 Star Wars, and into the entirety of George Lucas's universe. The characters, the mythology, the technology, the various versions of the trilogies that have evolved over the decades, basically everything except the TV movies with the Ewoks that nobody liked anyway. We also ended up pitching our own spin-off projects at each other, so quite literally, this is someone else's movie.
I grew up with Star Wars as, I mean, they were the kind of the first live-action movies I've ever seen. I started, obviously, with like Disney animated films, but we had the original trilogy on VHS, and when those were popped in, and I saw A New Hope for the first time, I was like, how are they doing this? Yeah. You know, just all the effects, the adventure of it all. I think I can trace back to that moment the kind of spark that made me want to become a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And just that it made me feel like anything is possible on film. And Star Wars is certainly that kind of sci-fi, fantasy, space opera, everything on film with comedy and action and love and family. It just encompasses kind of everything that I like to see in storytelling with arcs and memorable characters. And then The Empire Strikes Back, I think, would have to be my favorite Star Wars.
Easily. I like the new ones a lot, and I think a case could be made for The Last Jedi as the first art house film within there. Like, not art house, but the first genuinely artistic movie.
Mm-hmm.
But Empire, I mean, I got to see them all theatrically when they opened.
Oh, because I'm old. You are lucky.
I am. I was incredibly lucky because I was 8 when the first one came out, and that's like the target age to have your mind blown open.
Yeah. Wow. For context, for reference, I was 5 when The Phantom Menace came out.
Oh wow.
And that was the first movie I ever saw in theaters.
Too. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And
that, but that's perfect for a 5-year-old. Right?
And it was. I loved it. I when I grew up with the prequels, I loved them. They were directly targeted towards me.
Yeah, yeah. So. The smartest thing, I mean, it's funny, it's a terrible decision narratively, structurally, to focus on like Darth Vader as an adorable child.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the movie that, you know, Lucas had always said these films were made for kids, which, but they're not really. The Empire is definitely a mature film. It's about relationships. And
yeah, but Empire also was a little taken out of his hands. Because Irvin Kershner directed it, and I remember hearing that, like, although Lucas really went to kind of fund that one himself, he definitely went independent from Hollywood Studios for Empire, but I think that was the one when he really kind of leaned on collaborators to help with that one, I think the product of that was quite a bit more of a serious film. Because if you look at A New Hope, like, that's just a fun movie. It's just an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too serious. It's not too heavy. But The Empire Strikes Back really kind of brings in those serious tones of conflict and where these character arcs are going. So yeah.
And it's the one where we get the Imperial March for the first time. It's stately. It's serious minded. But it also, I remember being struck because I had seen Star Wars, I don't know, 10 times probably theatrically. I just kept going back. And it was 1977. There wasn't much else to see that summer. Smokey and the Bandit was not doing it for me. But yeah, I remember the theaters I saw Star Wars in. They're all gone now. The Finch and the Don Mills. And
It was probably those two alternating back and forth, back and forth. But it was at the Odeon Theater chain, and I was living up at up in North York, and that's like, if I could get my parents to drive me to the theater, I would go see Star Wars again.
Wow.
And again, and again, and again. And then friends would go, and I'd come with them, and it was just this, it was a thing. We didn't have the internet. There was just the movie to see.
Yeah.
And then when Empire came out in May of 1980, I was sufficiently stoked that I actually went. I think, if I'm remembering this, it must have happened this way. There's no other way it could have happened. I think we had the day off from school. Mm-hmm. It was a Wednesday or a Friday. I think it might have been a Wednesday when it opened here. But it was opening at the University Theater, also long gone. It's a Pottery Barn now, down on Bloor Street. This massive 70mm house. And I went down with a couple of friends, and I think my brother Michael was with us. He would have been 10. I would have been, I was 11. And we went down to see like the 10:15, 10:20 a.m. show.
70mm.
On the first day. Yeah. And 70mm was popular back then.
Yeah. No,
there were five or six theaters in the city that were regularly screened stuff in 70. And we went, and I just remember thinking how gorgeous it was. It was just beautiful visually. I mean, it is, Peter Sushitsky shot it, and it is gorgeous. I remember so vividly the lighting on the back of Vader's head
when he surveys the
Star Destroyer.
Yes.
Or he's in the Star Destroyer looking out, and it was like glass. It was just incredibly textured and smooth and beautiful. And I thought, oh, this is different from the last one, because the last one's kind of dusty and
it is messy.
Intentionally. I mean, it looks like sure, I lived in the future and all that. But I think that might have been the first time I thought about how movies were produced and mm-hmm. what the image tries to say.
Yeah.
I remember it so vividly. Also, we were way in the back, and it was just this huge, overwhelming image. It had a massive, gorgeous screen. And came out and loved it so much that it was like, if I hadn't had to go home, I would have gone right back in. It was amazing.
I have a question for you that, like, I would never have any kind of idea of what this was because I wasn't alive at the time. Because when I watched these films, I watched them on VHS. I had all three, so I could just go straight to the next one. What was it like at the end of Empire with the big twist dropped of no, I am your father? Like, what were the feelings you kind of had going into Return of the Jedi and in that gap?
It was torture.
Torture?
Like, it was hell. I knew it was a cliffhanger. I think there had been, like, either the Time magazine story had come out already. I think it was the cover, but it was the first big splashy magazine spreading. And because it had Darth Vader on it somewhere, it was the shot of him reaching out, which had no context at the time, but that's just the image they used, the shot of him reaching out on the gantry. I knew, well, because I saw that image, it's like, I have to read this. Uh-huh. And it had no hints of, like, basically that it introduces these new characters and there's this, but it didn't go into detail. And I knew that it was a cliffhanger. That was the thing that I understood, because we already knew about the episode 5 thing. That was the big surprise, like 6 months earlier when Fox reissued Star Wars with episode 4 on it for the first time.
Yeah.
That we knew that Empire would be episode 5 and that there was a 6 planned. So somewhere in the piece, they discussed the fact that it was going to be a cliffhanger ending. And so I was sort of prepared to know that it wasn't going to be decisive. But yeah, there were gasps. People were shocked. And then the movie ends and you're just like, but I want it now.
Yeah.
I need to know. And it would be another 3 years.
Yeah. And so, but then when the trilogy was finally rounded off with Return of the Jedi, how does that feel, kind of like having that trilogy closed? Did you feel that kind of closure? Did you feel like
the story was finished? It was incredibly satisfying at the time in 83. And the cyclical nature of everything hadn't really been explained. There was a book published, written by Alan Arnold, about the making of The Empire Strikes Back, called Once Upon a Galaxy, which is hand-massaged by Lucas as his, it's a story of this brilliant artist who is creating a great work of modern mythology. He'd fully bought into everything that he'd... I mean, Lucas was winging it in 1977. He had been writing The Star War forever, and the Star Wars and the Chronicles. Like, Mace Windu was the original hero and all this stuff.
Mustak was a dwarf.
Yeah.
Mustak, Starkiller.
A million different things. It was basically his Lord of the Rings, right? Mm-hmm. And he stole imagery from samurai films and half the plot from the Hidden Fortress and Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers. And created something new, which is amazing. But he then went straight into the, oh, yeah, I'm a genius. It's always been my destiny and goal to create this massive story, and here I am telling my epic, and we were all just going, okay. And the book, this book was the first time that Lucas was quoted as saying it was going to be 9 movies, that his plan was always going to be,
yeah, I had heard that,
yeah, 4, 5, 6, then 1, 2, 3, then 7, 8, and 9.
And I think Mark Hamill even said, I saw some old interview on YouTube, that it, in the time around then, there was a plan for 9
movies. Yeah, they were all operating on this.
Yeah.
And then, for whatever reason, after Jedi came out, that was it.
Yeah.
That Lucas said, no, I think maybe someday I'll do the first 3.
I have to admit, I kind of appreciate that restraint that he had, to because he could have easily milked these movies. He could have gone and made a bajillion of these movies, but he seemed to have quite a bit of restraint for that, and I guess I actually quite appreciate that. And obviously I know the prequels have a very, very mixed reception, I don't know, I still really admire the way that this all kind of happened with, you know, 4, 5, 6, and then 1, 2, 3. It's interesting. Like, it's never really happened that way in any sort of saga.
Yeah, yeah. And we've also never seen the kind of technological evolution and regression that happens in the prequels, where suddenly we have this new digital technology that he fell in love with, to the, I would argue, detriment of the storytelling. Because you can imagine almost anything. I think this is what happened after 1983, too, after Jedi came out. I think he was paralyzed by the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what else could you do? Where could the story go? And then he fell into this other thing where he started producing and got more interested in making movies like Howard the Duck and Willow, and they're more like fantasy based, because that way he could play with puppets and the stuff he did with Henson. Those are really all kind of part of a creative obsession with him that just it became impractical as digital technology came in, and he fell in love with that instead, and then I think as a result got lost in the weeds a bit.
Yeah, I mean, and it is, you know, that's a huge criticism of the prequels, often is the CGI and stuff, which is a shame, because there actually were so many models built for The Phantom Menace. Like, I heard that there were even more models built for The Phantom Menace than there were for the original trilogy.
Yeah, didn't they just end up scanning them or something?
Yeah, but then, you know, they get lost in the mix, and then obviously the ballsy choice to have a full CG character like Jar Jar Binks was a risk.
It's a really interesting technological achievement. It just happens to be someone no one can stand.
Yeah, but then, like, on the other hand, you have like a Gollum character in Lord of the Rings who is, to this day, really holds up. Like, if you watch The Fellowship, that really holds up.
And it's just a couple years later.
Yeah, but so it's I think that's a pitfall of filmmaking is technological innovation and how exciting that could probably be at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to kind of be careful to not let that steer you too much. I think I have a little bit of an old soul in me. So I like to look back, and whenever I actually started as a visual effects artist, actually. And whenever I can infuse real elements or use practical effects, I will do that, because there's no substitute for something that's physically there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It just changes. I mean, and Ahmed Best was there in Phantom Menace, but the eyelines are wrong. People are still kind of not looking right. Like, it's weird, but having him present makes it harder, I think, to create a character that's the wrong size.
Yeah, but then we have something like someone like Yoda in Empire.
Sure.
When Yoda shows up, his eyes are there, and like in Frank Oz, obviously, and the puppetry is he's a master. And every time I watch Empire, just when Yoda shows up, I just feel all giddy inside. You just feel like there's this magical creature there.
Yeah.
You just feel so real. So
we all felt that way too at the time, because we knew there was this. The other thing about Empire was that there was all this stuff about Boba Fett, because they'd introduced him in the holiday special and the cartoon, and then there's the action figure that you could send away for, and he was the most highly anticipated character. But they kept Fox and Lucasfilm kept stressing in all the publicity material, he's not the only new character. There's all these new people. Billy Dee Williams is in this movie, and Billy Dee Williams is just coming off, you know, a couple of fairly popular mainstream movies, as well as being Billy Dee Williams, which was his full-time job of being awesome.
Yeah.
And Lando, Lando being the first black character in Star Wars I was not aware of what a huge deal it was. I just thought, oh, cool, it's a new guy with a cape. And
but not only that, Lando was indeed like he was a character type, like he was so different from the other characters.
Yeah.
Like and just his suaveness, the first word he says, it's like you can just feel that Billy Dee Williams coming through. Yeah,
he is. He performs the same function in Empire that Han Solo performed in the first movie, which is, this is all bullshit, and really let's just make a couple of bucks and run away.
Yeah,
and we get to like that. Apparently was supposed to be a point of comparison to Han's evolution and why Princess Leia could fall in love with him now. But also, Billy Dee Williams just makes being a bad guy or a
gray area
person, a morally ambivalent character look so much fun.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to hang out with this guy?
Yeah.
And then Yoda is the one with the unerring moral compass, but who's also a bit of a goof, which is just wonderful.
I just love how, the way they set it up is Yoda obviously says that he, you seek Yoda. Like, he's not clear about the fact that he is Yoda. And
he's outright lying.
Yeah, and he just trolls Luke for, a couple scenes, I think. And I don't know, that's a really interesting way to introduce a character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to have fun with them, have them kind of piss off your main guy with a little bit, but then become this very powerful sage. Like, it's a really... That turn in that scene when he discovered that aha moment, that this is Yoda, and Obi-Wan's chiming, and it's like, oh, God, I just got drawn into this ancient... order.
Yeah, it's marvelous storytelling and fantastic puppeteering too, because the last time I watched Empire I was just sort of paying attention to all the technical pieces and seeing how they fit together, and there's that moment where Yoda sort of does something with his shoulders and his ears droop, and it's this weariness of now we have to actually be serious about it, and it's a puppet.
It's
incredible work.
I know. Yeah.
And that speaks to both Frank Oz being an absolute master of his craft, and also to Lucas and Kirshner knowing they could get away with it.
Yeah, I heard Lucas really campaigned hard for Frank Oz to be considered for an Oscar
for acting. Yeah,
because there's always that conversation about Andy Serkis, who I think is just brilliant with his mocap, and it's an interesting. I hope that there one day is kind of going to be some sort of category for people who do that kind of work.
In Solo, for example, Phoebe Waller-Bridge's motion capture stuff is delightful, and there's a moment where L3 just sort of sits and slaps her leg up over the other, and it's just like, that's a human being.
Uh-huh.
It just happens to be interpreted through
ones
and zeros.
Yeah.
But when you're dealing with, in 1980, before, I think the most sophisticated thing they had in Empire is the replacement of the, I think it's a chimpanzee's eyes, a woman's jaw and mouth for the Emperor. The original rendition of the Emperor was put together from a bunch of different things.
That conglomeration, that mess of the face.
Yeah, to be weird and alien and wrong somehow.
Yeah.
And distorted by video static. This is the thing that just guts me about Star Wars in general, the first three films and what Lucas has done to them over the years. Is like, you kids today just don't appreciate it. It's not your fault. You've been deprived of the original experience. To the point now where Empire, in the latest special editions, I think it started when the Blu-rays came out. During the production of the prequels, Lucas actually got Ian McDiarmid to come in and...
Be the Emperor.
And do the Emperor's scene, but with new dialogue, where they actually blow the revelation.
The Anakin Skywalker.
Yeah.
Line. Yeah.
Where they're like, well, your child is the problem. And they're actually giving away this massive twist at the end of the film.
Yeah, but...
Yes, sure, now everybody knows
it's such a weird thing, and I've kind of learned this with having just made kind of my feature, and it, which is, it's been a year since it's actually been completed. Okay. And it's like, at some point, I think any sort of kind of content creator needs to be able to step away. And because there is a part that's like, yes, I could be doing something different. I could keep updating these ideas. The problem is that it's, in Lucas's case, when you have people that's already seen and love your movies, you can't do that to them. You know, yeah. Like you can't update their, what they've already kind of grown accustomed to. But yeah, I don't know. It's, I think it's tempting for franchises in general to now, whenever they do sort of an update or sequel, to just keep making tie-ins, and I guess the Anakin Skywalker thing comes after the, obviously he was around the time when he was going to make the prequels. He knew that the whole Anakin Skywalker was going to be a big deal, so sure. He wanted to make that tie-in, and then they put the Hayden Christensen ghost at the end of Jedi.
It's so unforgivable.
Yeah, but I mean, like, it's, I understand their impulse to do that. I can't say whether it's like right or wrong, but
it's wrong. I'll say
it's wrong. Yeah, sure.
But I'm a critic. I can say it.
Yeah, you're a critic. You can say it. But I also kind of feel like if I were in his position, I could probably sense that itch. That itch, just like this should make better sense in the whole scheme of things.
But with Empire, I mean, that specific change in Empire, you know, Windows and Cloud City is fine. Nobody really bothered
Windows
that.
Windows and Cloud City, yeah.
We get it. You know, that's a thing that you can now do relatively easily. It doesn't change the texture of the film. It's just, they're not in a soundstage now. They're in a space city. Yeah. That's kind of neat. But actually adding new dialogue that undercuts the experience of the film that you're watching, that's fascinating to me. That would be... I can't even think of another... Like, it's a betrayal...
It's a betrayal of
the material by the person who wrote the material. It's so strange and I couldn't believe it when I saw it in that first time that they released them. I just stared at it. I was aghast.
Yeah.
It was kind of okay when Ian McDiarmid showed up, saying the Emperor's
that
dialogue.
Made sense. Yeah. I like that. I thought I obviously with, and Ian McDiarmid is a great part of the prequels.
Mm-hmm.
He's incredible in the prequels, and also he's in Jedi. So
yeah,
I mean to update that to be Ian McDiarmid, to me that's a sensible choice. It's the Anakin Skywalker line that's not you know, that's ill advised.
And also because that when we saw it when I was 11, when we saw the big reveal, I am your father, the conversation afterwards was, well, actually, now that I think about it, he did say if he could be turned, like, he's the one trying to save him, so I guess that does make sense. He was trying to kill him in the first movie, but maybe he didn't know who he was, or it was just a ship shooting at another ship. And you start making all the connections and revisions in your mind to understand the material as it's been presented to you, which... Again, when you're 11, it's kind of cool to be able to do that, and I can understand the appeal of, like, now it's all the YouTube theories about this film is taking place in the same universe as this film.
Oh yeah,
you know, because Slusho products appear in all of J.J. Abrams' movies, there must be Slusho somewhere in The Force Awakens.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
It's just a prop drink he came up with that it appears in all of his movies. It's the same way. Yeah, it's fine. It's harmless.
Mm-hmm.
But with Empire, you had the opportunity for the first time to start digging through the movie that you had already, you know, memorized, which was Star Wars, the first film, and try to figure out where these connections are and what does it mean that Darth Vader, and they never met in the first movie. Luke sort of saw him for a second. And just, it was great because it was a chance to engage with continuity in a way that I don't think I ever had before.
Yeah.
And comic books were sort of experimenting with it, but nothing was as layered as it is now, where everything comes with its own Bible and intertextual connections that you can explore forever.
Yeah.
You just had to go and see the movie again to see if you remembered what you remembered.
Yeah.
Which was pleasurable, but also agonizing. And you, as a kid, you would have been able to just pop the tape in again.
Yeah. No, that's... Yeah, totally.
Yeah, we didn't have that. People really don't... Like, there's a generation of kids now who will never know what it was like to have to wait for something or to have to... not be able to get something.
I mean, I feel that with music, to be honest. And I'm sure you could probably make the parallel to days when there were records. But for me, HMV closed down, and I used to go buy CDs all the time. And I love having to kind of buy a CD and then either have to like rip it or play it, listen to the whole thing. And it kind of forces you to kind of make time for that album. Whereas now, if you can just buy a single song or stream a single song immediately, it's just, I don't know, it kind of takes away the effort that you put in as a consumer, as someone who is trying to form a connection with that piece. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, totally. I think the kind of instant gratification of getting anything anytime. I'm actually watching fewer movies. I'm listening to fewer songs now. I used to really carve out time for stuff, or even like going to the movie store with my friends like that. Yeah, we'd carve out a whole half day for that. You know, walk to the store, and now it's let's watch something on Netflix, and Netflix has been great for TV. I love watching TV on Netflix, but I also get tortured when I'm just searching for movies, and I can't pick one.
Yeah, no, people. This is apparently the new experience now. Is you don't actually watch the movies, but you look at all the tiles.
Yeah,
and you think about it, and then you look at the connections, and you think about something else, and it's kind of. It's an overload, but it's based on the desire to know more.
Yeah.
So you never settle on one thing because you always want to find out what the next thing is.
One thing I loved about the movie store, though, is that when, let's say, you know, you didn't get a chance to see a movie in theaters and it comes out and they had kind of that new section, mm-hmm. and they would always be out because, you know, people would have already picked them up. Right. That would force you to now find a second choice. So, like, I discovered so many interesting movies just purely because I would go to the movie store and get disappointed. But that was, that led to more discovery. I'm not saying that, like, you can't discover stuff on Netflix. I'm always finding obscure stuff. But it's that kind of failure of finding
the thing you wanted. Well, and if you're outside, you have to pick something.
Yeah, right?
You're going to have to go home eventually.
To the store, you got to pick up something. Whereas I've literally, on any sort of VOD platform, I've wasted 30 minutes trying to find something, and then I don't even watch anything.
Yeah. That's happened to me too. It's bizarre. You're spoiled for choice, I guess is the term, but it's worse than that because you're aware that there's something. There's so many somethings.
Yeah.
And the one thing that will be perfect, you know, you'll never find that.
Yeah.
If it's the same, again, it's the same problem with CG, right? Endless opportunity, endless possibility means you either never settle for something or you just keep thinking you can resettle and fix it and make it better in post.
I think restraint is a very powerful force. It's something I really value.
and again, with, you know, everything's going to lead back to Empire for the purposes of this conversation, but it does make me think about how faced with an ending in Star Wars that you really could have gone anywhere. That movie is self-contained.
Yep.
Episode 4 or otherwise. Mm. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. The direction that Lucas took in shaping Empire, he could have told any story he wanted. He could have gone in any direction. And he found a way to make something that is visually similar and emotionally right. But what surprised me the last time I watched it was realizing how the tone is really, like, there isn't one. It starts like a Star Wars movie. The Hoth sequence is zippy and fun and visually interesting. And adventure.
Yeah.
It's filled with adventure. Luke and Leia kiss, which, you know, now it's creepy.
Weird, yeah.
But it gives you the thing that you thought you wanted in the first movie, that first act. And then everything goes to shit. Like, it all collapses and they flee.
They get separated.
It's suddenly, it is a series of different movies all interacting, but there's the quasi-mystical. Like, the Dagobah training sequences are potentially incredibly boring. They're not. They could have been so dumb.
They could have been, but they're actually, I think those are some of the best cut sequences of that film. I mean, like, even just the scene where he lifts the X-Wing, he fails to lift the X-Wing, and Yoda lifts it after him. Just the way that's cut, just the pacing, they kind of like double up, the amount of time that Luke tried to lift it, they kind of double up on for Yoda's shots. And it's just like, you just feel it. I don't know. It's just, mm. Seriously, the craft of Empire Strikes Back is stunning.
Yeah, no, yeah. It really is. And it's, again, on paper, it is Luke looks at the rock. The rock kind of moves. How do you turn that into something that's gripping?
Yeah.
And part of it is we're invested in his story and there are stakes and you know, we already know that everything else is going badly for everyone else. But there's also, meanwhile, in Cloud City, there's flirting and comedy. Like, it feels like a stage play in a couple of scenes where it's just this weird romantic comedy between Leia and Lando, where he's trying to seduce her away from Han, and already they've already been through the monster stuff in space, and like that midsection of the film where almost nothing is happening, but it's all about progressing and understanding who these characters are and letting them be people instead of action figures, which is how the first movie, more or less, the second hour of Star Wars is just, you know, running and hiding and jumping and swinging. Yeah. And it's great.
Yeah, it's adventure. Yeah. Yeah,
but when it's over, it's like, okay, now, who are these people? And this is the movie that answers
this
that.
This is the character movie, for sure. Yeah, no, it sets up all that conflict. Also, they fail a lot. One of the reasons I love Luke Skywalker is that he honestly is useless without the friends, help of his friends. He needs all these guiders and mentors and that's why I find that moment in Return of the Jedi when, like, he's able to stand on his own 2 feet and throw the lightsaber down in front of the Emperor. It's like, he earned this. He was this kind of clumsy kid along the way. But, Empire, what I love about it is that it's obstacle after obstacle. You just root for these characters. It's just, it's special.
It is, and it's the one that felt, when I was a kid, it's the one that felt like I could use it to justify it to my parents and older relatives who are like, but it's Star Wars, it's silly, right? It's like, well, no, look, they're doing stuff and they're talking about their problems and thinking about they're thinking about ways to be better people, and that's not something, you know, science fiction in 1980 was pretty much crap.
Cheesy.
You had Star Wars and Close Encounters in 77, and those two films pointed two different directions for cinema to take.
Yeah.
And they were both, they're both wonderful, wonderful films.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, I think Saturn 3 was in 1980, and Logan's Run was in 76. And
yeah, I'm not a big fan of Logan's Run.
Oh, it's garbage. I mean, it's got some ideas, but it is, when you think about that as representative of major studio science fiction filmmaking in 1976, the year before Star Wars, it's like it came from a different era.
Yeah.
And Empire is a movie that has, like, it takes its time, it settles down with characters, the stuff between Han and Leia, with Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher just ignoring all the space stuff and just performing the romance is marvelous. We see her, they're one big scene leading up to the interrupted kiss, where she's just trying to screw a bolt into a wall and having a terrible time of it. That is, I mean, it's a great scene as written and performed, but it's also just this marvelous moment where the film stops being a space movie and it's like, you know, they still have to do maintenance.
Yeah.
The Chewie's always got a wrench in his hand, but seeing a human do it is different somehow. Mm-hmm. And Fisher was just so good at the exasperation and playing it into her scene with Ford once he shows
up. and even her resistance to Han in that scene. Like, I loved the whole Han Leia thing. It played out so great in Empire, and I was a little disappointed in Force Awakens how they got so little screen time together. Mm. But
they convey so much melancholy. I really do think it works.
Yeah.
Just the idea that he's been in and out of her life for the last however many years.
And I can believe that, too. Like, I can believe, like, that's how it would have ended up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, that's the other thing, too, that no one talks about in these movies, is if there's a spacefaring culture and you can go anywhere, you're going to miss out on stuff. You're going to be away from each other for long periods of time. And somehow that comes through in that scene just beautifully. I know one of the big knocks on Empire over the decades has been, you know, Luke seems to be training for months and only a couple of days are passing for Han and Leia and Chewie in their storyline. But I don't care. It doesn't really bother me. The I just assumed there was a lot of traveling involved and they spent a lot of time on the ship getting to know each other. Yeah. That actually makes sense for that story.
Yeah.
And again, you know, it's a space fantasy. It doesn't really need to adhere to points of logic and, yeah. And chronological realism.
No.
But it's all so satisfying. Like, yeah. The things that happen to them are the things that need to happen to get the story to the next phase of its plot, but also emotionally to make them, you know, whole people.
Yeah.
And involve them in their own, oh, this sounds so pretentious, but their own enlightenment and their own self-expression and their self-actualization. They're becoming people.
Yeah.
And we can root for them better. We can be better invested in them.
And I think Empire, and I don't really think that this is this bold of a statement, but I think it's like the best middle movie of a trilogy ever, because it followed up on Star Wars in such a unique and daring way, but it also set up Return of the Jedi in an incredible way, because Empire, you have the gang all together, but then they get split up, mm-hmm. and then they end up in the same spot, like on Cloud City, but they don't actually interact that much.
Yeah.
Like Luke has to have his own kind of thing with Vader. Han gets frozen, and then Leia now needs to team up with the guy that betrayed Han, Lando, and Chewie, and then they all get spread apart again. And then in Return of the Jedi, you're kind of all getting caught up to where these characters have gone. And I don't know, I that kind of darker cliffhanger for a sequel, I think, really works to set up Return of the Jedi, which I find, I love Return of the Jedi personally, just because it's so, it just gives me all the feels, even though it has all the Care Bear Ewoks and all that.
Yeah.
But it rounds off the story in such a nice way. Whereas Empire, like, it left you as uncertainty, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's an upbeat, downbeat ending somehow, which is, I mean, I remember going out of it, coming out of the theater being incredibly excited, just really pumped to see it again.
Mm-hmm.
But also to, you know, like, because that was some sort of coping mechanism, because I knew I wasn't going to find out what happens next. I knew it would take a while.
Yeah.
And, well, actually, this has been tugging at my brain since we brought it up. What was it like for you? At what point had you already seen the prequels when you saw
the original trilogy? I started with the VHS of the original trilogy.
So, of course, because you were five when Phantom Menace came out. So, did you know going in, though, just because of the, I mean, just through osmosis, I would assume, did you know that Luke and Leia were brother and sister when you first saw Star Wars? Were you aware of that?
No.
Okay.
No. I think, I mean, it set in pretty quick after I had watched all three within a few days.
Sure.
But no, watching the first Star Wars, I had no idea who any of these characters were.
Yeah, I wonder what it's like now for people for kids, like, it would have to be children or young people, to come to Star Wars knowing from the beginning that Luke and Leia, they're not going to end up together. Like, when she kisses him for luck in the Death Star trench, is that going to be weird?
Yeah.
Because I remember sitting through Empire, watching her get closer to Han and going, wait a minute, no, that's not right.
Yeah.
And by the end of the movie, it earns it. I mean, it absolutely, their romance is like the defining emotional arc of the entire trilogy.
Yeah.
But if Han is 10 years older than Luke, he must be 10 years older than Leia, right?
Yeah.
Like that has to follow. And she's playing someone who is kind of wise for her years. And Carrie Fisher had that old soul thing anyway.
Yeah.
But watching them together, by the end of the movie, the first time through, it's like, yeah, no, of course, they're in love. They belong together. Luke's just, I don't know,
yeah,
a loser.
Yeah.
It's not going to work for him.
Luke has nothing to do with this anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And the choices that were made, and again, it's a retcon, because originally Lucas wanted Luke and Leia to be the romantic couple.
Yeah.
Either because Hamill wasn't interested, or not interested, but he wasn't a confident enough actor to really do a romantic role, and Harrison Ford's charisma is just, like, it's the highest wattage in the entire movie.
Yes.
And people have lightsabers.
Yeah.
And Harrison Ford is still brighter than they are.
Yeah.
That he just went in that direction and then figured out the brother-sister thing later, whatever. It lands so beautifully that when Leia was revealed as the other that Yoda talks about in Empire, it just went, of course.
Yeah.
Must have been her. It has to be her. I mean, it's not going to be Lando. There's nobody else they've introduced that could be.
Yeah.
And she's already an inspirational leader. I'm 10 years old and I'm talking myself into this.
But there's also that great moment when, like, he does call out to Leia when he's hanging on that, what is it, that, like, weather vane thing?
Yeah.
Or whatever it is.
A cable antenna.
Yeah, the antenna. And like, there's that moment, like, that push in on Carrie Fisher, and you can just see it in her eyes. Like, she's tapping into some sort of connection. Whether it was just him reaching out to her, but, like, I mean, I didn't make that connection as a kid, but now, obviously, now that I watch it back, it's like, oh, okay, like, they knew in Empire that the other was Leia.
Right. Like, I just assumed that it's because she's the only person he sees.
Yeah.
In that one moment where she says it's a trap. He knows she's there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it absolutely makes sense. And it's like a soft dissolve or something. There's an overlap in the frame for a split second that looks like a bad projector transition. But it's deliberate.
Yeah, yeah. They did that in The Last Jedi, too, with Kylo and Leia.
Yeah, like, well, that's it's clearly an echo of it.
Yeah, it's like the way you, I guess, you visually communicate how these two characters are getting in contact with each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so, it's such a sophisticated movie, and it was, you know, it was written off, the whole series was written off as dopey science fiction, or not even science fiction, fantasy
yeah.
for the longest time.
Yeah.
And it was a point in time where to try to do something serious within genre, even with something that isn't 100% serious, but to create a whole world and it's one of those challenges, I guess, where there's no way to win. There's no way to satisfy everybody to make a film that is beautiful. Like, visually, the lighting in the carbonite chamber is just gorgeous. Oh, yeah. And it's all practical.
That whole set piece of Bespin and over in the carbonite chamber and that gantry scene, like, oh gosh, just the striking visuals.
Yeah. And to have everything be tied up in the emotional investments too, because Luke is challenging this monster who killed his father figure in the last movie, but is his father. It's just, it's so primal that if you relate it to somebody, you know, like, it sounds dumb and basic.
Yeah.
But it's conveyed with this, and part of that is John Williams' score too, where it is just the most important, fraught, powerful climax, and it's just a sword fight. But it is, like, it's everything.
Yeah, but, like, the Imperial March in this film plays such a big role. I mean, this film, for me at least, and I think this is pretty common, but, like, it really solidified Vader as Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. I mean, in A New Hope,
he's barely in it.
He's, like, barely in it.
He is. This is the thing that I always worried about.
Also, Grand Moff Tarkin was kind of his boss.
Yeah. So he was a lackey.
Yeah.
He was a henchman.
Yeah.
Doesn't Leia call him that at the very beginning?
Yeah.
Something. She's very dismissive of him. Uh-huh. And the idea when Lucas started saying that the full arc of Star Wars is about Darth Vader, it's like, well, he's in one of the movies for 20 minutes, so I don't believe you. I don't think he was always your focus. But, yeah, he becomes that character in this film. He's allowed to express humor. He's sardonic. Like, for someone whose face we never see in this movie, we just, you know, like, that tantalizing shot of the back of his head.
Oh, yeah.
It was a remarkable performance from both Prowse and Jones.
Because
James Earl Jones is just, he's smiling through his lines. You know, that thing where if you make the face, then it comes through in your voice. He's clearly, like, he's emoting as Vader.
Yeah.
And then towards the end, as he gets more and more serious, and finally with Luke, he's like, that is Shakespearean.
Shakespearean.
Yeah.
That's a good way.
Because it all comes right back to every classic tragedy.
Yeah.
The person you've been fighting is the person you want to love you.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
No, it drops like a hammer. I mean, it was great when it happened. Yeah. It was just so, so thrilling to see. And you wanted to go right back and see how it ended. I envy people who can access all of this stuff in not in real time, but in no time to just follow one to the other.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I'm finding with TV nowadays. That's why I love things like Netflix and stuff for TV. Because it's like
binge watch.
Binge watch, for sure. And, like, it's a really interesting way. It might even be the right way to watch TV. I don't know. Because you want to just maintain that connection with the material. And just live through it with the character. Like, I love binge watching a show, because then you've basically just seen, like, every day and night of a character, and it's interesting to go through that whole journey without having to wait a week. And then, I don't know, it is torture now to actually wait for new movies.
Yeah, no, the idea that we have to wait another year for the Avengers to finish, That's something. Yeah. It's weird, right? Because time has ceased to have any meaning in our current state.
Yeah.
What was it? Somebody was pointing out that this big Trump scandal that happened in May, but it feels like it was 5 years ago. We had that in the Ford years here in Toronto, where it's just like, yeah, remember when that happened? That was last week. Felt like it was 3 years before. You're so conscious of everything, and we are through social media and 24-hour news.
Yeah,
everything is all the time forever.
All the time, yeah.
And nothing. Time moves faster. Because as you get older, apparently, it's just the way we perceive it. But, you know, you blink and it's a week later.
Yeah.
Even though you were fully engaged in that week. Or things recede further into the past. Like, in my brain, it feels like Solo came out a year ago, but it hasn't even shown up on Blu-ray yet. Like,
yeah.
It's been 3 months. But it's got this weird rubber band boomerang
effect. I do think, though, a friend of mine, he I had the same reaction, but he put it in better words, like when just at the frequency that the Star Wars movies are coming out nowadays. Like,
that's true.
It's he said like Star Wars should be kind of an event, and I think we're being spoiled right now with like a Star Wars movie every year.
Yeah,
it's nice that like you have to kind of wait a couple of years for the race storyline, the episodes.
Yeah.
But it's weird. I have this weird feeling that like we're being spoiled. Like I think we need to be tortured a little bit. We need to wait.
Yeah.
I
would love to see a series of films that works the way the before movies do.
Oh,
you know, where you actually have to live in this. The characters age at the same rate that we do, and then we get to understand what that means for them.
Yeah, but that's Harry Potter, right? Like,
yeah, I suppose.
Like,
but it's still compressed, right? Because it's a year after year.
That's
after
true.
Year.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're seeing it with television now because everything from the 90s is getting a return. But I don't know that we can let things go. Like, I think it's okay to let things lie for a long time.
So what's your take on Star Wars in particular, though, and kind of where it's headed and the amount that we're getting and all the spinoffs and stuff?
It's a volume thing, right? Like, we're getting too much.
Yeah.
Although, that said, I've enjoyed everything up until Solo. I like the episode 7 and 8. I really love Rogue One.
I like Rogue One. Yeah. A lot of people, for some reason, didn't connect with that one. But to me, that really just planted you in between or 3 and 4. Like, it really felt like...
It's successful in a way that Solo isn't, in showing you what life is like for the peripheral characters.
Yeah.
Like, I love a movie that... All right, it is. Rogue One is a movie that is about... Nobody you know.
Nobody. And to the point that they just die at the all end, like at the end of it,
which,
all. Like,
which kind of makes sense. It's why they don't show up in some of the other films, and I'm really glad they haven't decided to have characters pop up in the new movies that are the children of.
Yeah.
But the idea that life under the Empire before the Rebellion really got going would suck.
Yeah.
That's great. That's really interesting. You get some of the moral dimension of what it's like to be a double agent. You get like just Riz Ahmed's arc as Bodhi at the very beginning, where he just doesn't want to be doing any of this, and it's all like this. He's only doing it because he's been pushed into a corner, and he's doing this out of obligation. And
yeah.
For the love of God, just let him go. Like, all he wants to do is not be there.
Yeah,
and then he becomes the hero. Like, everybody gets that moment where they lay their lives down for this greater purpose, and then. Somehow, and I've watched it 3 times now, and I still don't know exactly how it does it, but it transitions into a conventional Star Wars movie as we know Star Wars after everybody dies.
Yeah, but what
it
I love
rallies.
One thing I love about Rogue One, and I gather that like a lot of criticism about it is because of the characters and how they don't have like a lasting effect, and you don't really know them that well.
Mm.
But to me, that movie, the character is the cause. And like that's so it's personified in the end when every rebel is handing off that thing. You feel it. You feel like, oh, this is what this movie is about. It's about that rebellion. It's about that struggle. I love that. I actually really. I'm sure those were actually probably reshoots, but that scene in the Carillion cruiser, when the rebels are handing off it one by
Vader
one.
Vader is coming for all of them.
That is just...
You know what? I bet that was the original. That was originally there. I think the reshoots would have been the other stuff with Vader.
Oh, okay.
Because that's unnecessary. He should have only shown up at the end like Godzilla.
That's
when he's there,
that's a good point.
You're dead. If you see him, it's over. And imagine what it would be like in that movie if he had just appeared. Oh, people would have lost their minds.
The red lights.
Yeah.
Jeez, yeah.
Because you know exactly who it is and what's happening. And it lines it up with the beginning of Star Wars so elegantly. But I would have absolutely withheld it. That other scene, it's nice. You know, it's fine. It's a little bit of backstory.
A little corny with the choke on your aspirations line.
Yeah, but it's, that's who he is.
Yeah.
He's been in that suit for, 20 years at this point, and he's just... He's pissed off and cranky, and he's making jokes. He's making fun of people wherever he can.
In terms of like the spin-offs, going back to Empire, when they introduced bounty hunters for the first time, and obviously Boba Fett. I mean, the way I grew up with Boba Fett was knowing who Boba Fett was.
Right.
Like I didn't see the toy first, and I didn't kind of like for me. I had already kind of. Piggybacked off of your generation's this is the badass.
Yeah.
You know, this is the guy.
Have you heard Seth Green's story about why Boba Fett was such a badass?
Robot
Chicken.
Yeah, I've seen a bunch of the Robot Chickens, but I haven't heard his story
on this. It's a great explanation of why Boba Fett was immediately received as this incredible anti-hero badass guy.
Give me the gist of it.
Well, basically what happened was Boba Fett was introduced in the cartoon. He didn't have any lines, and he was the character that if you got enough box tops, you could send away for a Boba Fett action figure in 1980, like Christmas 1979, before Empire came out. So he was this really cool character, but then he had the action figure had a real rocket launcher on the like a little dart gun thing on his back, which fired a little rocket. And this was right at the same time that the Battlestar Galactica toys were being recalled,
because
the children would swallow the things and die. So they recalled the Boba, or they didn't recall the Boba Fett thing, but everybody who sent away for one, myself included, got a letter in the mail like months later saying, "Oh, we can't send you this character just yet because it's dangerous." But it wasn't worded that directly. But the implication was that Boba Fett was too dangerous for children to play with. So you're like, I need to know what this guy does.
That's cool.
Yeah, and then in the end, we got one with a little jetpack that didn't fire off a bullet, but. That was, according to Seth Green, like that's the idea that they accidentally planted this subliminal concept that Boba Fett was the most badass thing you could ever see in Star Wars.
Yeah,
and then he shows up and has two scenes and doesn't really do anything.
Yeah, I mean it's his death,
Jedi.
The quotation marks death in Return of the Jedi that was so silly to me. I because of all the Star Wars spinoffs a few years ago. My co-writer and I, he's someone who I write lots of stuff with, and my buddy James, it was like New Year's, and we were trying to figure out what party we're going to go to, and we ended up just talking about Star Wars, because that happens.
Sure.
And we started talking about the Boba Fett spinoff, because we knew that someone out there is planning it. I'm sure it's already in development.
Yeah, it's in the works.
And we kind of brainstormed what would be, a good way to tell that story. That would probably satisfy Disney's desire to have kind of an origin or a reboot kind of thing, but then also satisfy the rest of us that really want to know what happened to this guy and is he still alive in that 1,000-year digestion Sarlacc pit.
Mm-hmm.
I won't pitch the whole thing, but we came up with an idea that's kind of follows like the structure of like a Godfather Part II kind of thing where you have a past and a present version. And so, like, it would open with Boba Fett in the Sarlacc pit, which is essentially kind of a prison. And that kind of storyline is this redemption arc, this kind of escape. And he has to work with people in that scenario that he put in there.
Okay. Right?
And then on the flip side, we have this storyline of the young, angsty Boba Fett, who wants to live up to the legacy of his father, Jango. And his moral decline into becoming the most feared bounty hunter. So you kind of have these two storylines going at the same time. One is the moral decline and one is kind of a redemption arc for a guy who's not like he's a cold-blooded killer, but like someone who, might have to work together with people to escape that Sarlacc pit. So
I would watch that movie.
Yeah,
that
I know.
Great.
So, I know. Fingers crossed I can get into a room with Disney and pitch that.
That's incredible.
We actually wrote it. We actually wrote the whole movie. Like it's a whole thing. That's just like fun stuff, though. Just like doing that for fun.
But that's what Star Wars gives you, I think, in a way that almost no other. Star Trek kind of did.
Uh-huh.
Just the idea that you can imagine new stories. There's other stuff to do.
Sandbox.
Yeah. You can go almost anywhere. You can do almost anything. I joked once that I would love to watch the movie of just Chewbacca being frustrated by human stuff, because he's always a little too big. And he's like, a movie from his perspective would be, I think it could be great, because we know a couple of things about him are canon. Like, he's 200 years old, mm-hmm. he has a family, and he's a bad loser. And all of those things, and Solo kind of has a joke about the bad loser thing, but all of those elements are that's John Goodman. That's a character you can instantly understand. He's just a Wookiee.
Yeah.
So you either have to subtitle it or do it in mime. But I'd love to watch a movie about his life 100 years before all of this stuff. Mm. Like, whatever he was doing way before the Empire, because he predates all that stuff.
Oh,
he's been around, and I don't know. There's something there, and it's such a huge, weird experiment that it'll never happen.
Well, also, I think the holiday special kind of set up any sort of Wookiee
not canon
focused.
No,
I know,
no,
I know, but I think it left like a bad taste in people's mouth of how the lifestyle of Wookiees might be.
It's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, Solo does give him. I have to admit, that's the thing in the movie that I didn't see coming. You've seen Solo.
I've seen it. I only saw it once.
The introduction of the beast.
Yeah.
And having it be like setting it up to mirror Luke fighting the Rancor in Jedi, and having it be Chewie.
I felt that totally.
That was delightful.
I actually liked that. Almost anything with Han and Chewie. I didn't know how I felt about Han like speaking Wookiee back to him. That was kind of weird. But
yeah, it
didn't track.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I get it. Everybody in the universe speaks different languages, but and he's not good at it, which is clever. But it just means he's met Wookiees before, and I want to know more about that.
Yeah, but like just the Han and Chewie dynamic in that Solo film was probably the best part of that film for me. Mm-hmm. Like I only saw it once, but Han and Chewie, that's a partnership for sure.
But that's my pitch, that you'd never, that's why it won't happen too, because Han's not possible.
Right.
In my idea of the Chewie movie.
Yeah.
But you know, like, just call it the Chewie movie.
The Chewie.
Wouldn't you want to see that?
I feel like. I mean, again, at the rate that they're pumping out stuff, and even with, like, animated, all the TV shows and stuff, now at this point, like, we might as well get the Chewie movie.
Yeah, you know, it'll happen. Yeah. It'll all happen, actually. And you're right, that is something that is probably bad about the Disney model, where I think, you know, ultimately, you see what they've done with Marvel, and they make 3 movies a year. Each one makes $1 billion on average. Mm-hmm. They are monsters. And they've gotten really interesting. They're launching, you know, Ryan Coogler getting to do one. And
I love Black Panther.
Yeah, it's tremendous. Yeah. And the idea that the model that they've built for themselves can work with almost anything. And then, you know, like the Captain Marvel film is going to be set in the 90s and made by the people who made Half Nelson and stars Brie Larson. It's like, okay, like I at this point, sure, show me whatever you have. I will probably buy it because we're all invested. And so far, you can, you know, you give Taika Waititi Ragnarok and it comes out looking like it does. And
like a Taika Waititi film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The spirit of the filmmaker somehow transcends this ABC machine that is built for Marvel. And so why couldn't we do that with Star Wars? I mean, obviously the property is big enough. Let's just keep making them.
Yeah, I think it's so weird. And just seeing the effect. I mean, there's been three waves of this. There was the remasters to the...
Sure.
To the... originals, and there was the Phantom Menace.
Yeah,
and
then special editions in 97, right? That was the first big theatrical re-release.
Yeah, and then of course now we got the new trilogy, and you can see this large fan base in certain chunks of it just, I don't know, get really angry or really happy and like really split, and it's a very very wild bunch of people. I honestly don't know what is. Yeah, I personally don't know where I sit in that camp. I'm someone that will always just love the kind of original saga, and I think that's kind of untouchable at this point. I would prefer if we don't go back and like, you know, get Solo's name from an Empire guard.
Yeah,
you know, like
again, that they don't, they're not even speaking English. That's silly.
Like, yeah,
just it's unnecessary.
That's what I felt about that movie. Is like I don't hate it. I didn't think it was terrible or anything like that. I just didn't feel it was necessary.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I think anything, if you're going to do a spinoff, it needs to have some sort of like real value to either continue a story or like One thing I liked about Rogue One, and it's kind of clever, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but like how they kind of solve the plot hole of why there's a hole in the Death Star.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That was kind of interesting. That was a neat way to approach it. Maybe a little bit, like, really convenient, but, like, I don't know. To me, that spinoff, like, served a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Solo just kind of, again, it seems unnecessary.
Yeah. And it was the first one, and I guess if I'm keeping count right, this is the 10th Star Wars movie, right?
Oh, gosh.
There are 8 episodes, and Rogue One, and Solo. So there have been 10 of these, and for the first time, it was feeling, unnecessary, like superfluous.
Yeah.
There's stuff in here. Even if Han just named himself Solo, that would be fine.
Yeah.
Because it would speak to how he feels about himself and how he sees his presence and his purpose in the universe is just nobody cares, you're alone, it doesn't matter. I like the idea that he is never going to be any better at his job than he already is.
Yeah.
That's really clever, and it lines up nicely with The Force Awakens, where he's still just screwing people over and then just shooting at them.
Yeah.
That's like, he will never be any better. He's fully formed at the age of whatever he is. But then you add in the stuff about how he was he wasn't a pilot, he was just a grunt, he was a ground trooper. And that's a whole movie. Like, that's a story about another character.
That's what I thought the movie was going to be about, because before, the big Disney kind of separation thing, I remember that the story was that Han is this guy from Corellia, and he, works for the Empire. Like, he was, like, an Imperial pilot.
Mm.
So, I think that they'd kind of draw from that, but
it leans on it here and there, yeah.
But that's a story there. He and Han, like, he and Chewie, that's a whole story there.
Yeah.
But then we kind of ended up in this other situation with, like, a different, like, gang that we don't know of and that never shows up in any of the other materials. And it's just, I don't know, it just, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of an impossible task, to be honest.
Yeah. And that's why Rogue One is so successful, because it introduces characters that we don't know and can't and haven't any expectations of.
Yeah.
I mean, we know the Death Star will be blown up, but not in this movie. So what happens? How does this work? The weird thing about Solo is, as a movie, it needs to get Han Solo to a place where he can be a good guy, but that won't happen for 10 years.
And his character beat at the end of Solo is basically the same one in A New Hope, where he didn't take the money and run.
Yeah, he ditches the payday for the hero moment, and that's not who he is when we meet him in a new
exactly. Yeah. I
do two more, which doesn't make any sense.
I firmly believe that if you're going to do a spinoff about a character, you need to illustrate some form of, I don't know, separation from the initial character. Like, there needs to see an arc, at least the beginning of one. But this was just, he's already who he already is.
Yeah.
And then he has the same formative beat.
It's weird that, I mean, I like the idea that the gesture he performs is the thing that starts the rebellion, that makes him inadvertently responsible for it, because then I get the idea that he would spend the next 10 years trying to distance himself from it, because, he's Bogart in Casablanca.
Yeah.
He's the guy who doesn't want to get involved and has actually made his entire purpose to be neutral and refuse and has allowed awful things to happen around him. But in Star Wars, he's already Bogart, so he can't be.
I didn't like that whole tie into the rebellion in Solo, and I think it's because Lucas actually had this really cool idea, and they didn't really go through with it in Revenge of the Sith, but they filmed it, and they have concept art of all this, but essentially Padme. And she was, like, quite strong in a couple of the films. In Revenge of the Sith, she kind of just cried.
She gets sad.
She kind of cried.
She gets sad and pregnant, which doesn't help.
But in the original story, from what I heard and from what I've seen in concept art, she was actually supposed to be... Well, she is a skeptic of Palpatine, and she always criticized him. And essentially, there's a deleted scene where she gathers Mon Mothma, who's the head of the rebellion, and Bail Organa, and, like, she gets all of these people together, and she essentially forms the rebellion. Right. It's not said, well, we are the rebels, but, like...
But by having everyone together.
By having everyone together to be skeptical of Palpatine and what he's doing, that... I think that would have been so interesting that, like, Darth Vader's wife is the one that actually started that spark.
And of course, you know, it stands up to the whole light side, dark side thing. It would embody the central concept of Star Wars.
And some of this concept art I saw for Revenge of the Sith, like, she like went to the most far, the volcano planet, mm-hmm. with a dagger in her hand. She was going to kill Anakin. Like, it was actually entering this kind of like Shakespearean kind of territory.
Yeah, that's...
But then it's tough because, I mean, they got Natalie Portman, who's amazing, and I actually do like Revenge of the Sith. I really do like it, but I think Padme was really underutilized, and there was a story in there mm-hmm. to actually spark the rebellion, and that would have been so cool.
That would have been great. And the other problem too is that Lucas is locked into the story he made up years and years ago about how, well, Obi-Wan and Darth Vader fought on a volcano, which was just probably a thing he stole from Lord of the Rings, right? Like, just an image of this conflict building at Mount Doom.
Yeah, well, because in The New Hope he says...
Yeah, betrayed and murdered my father.
Yeah.
They never... Like, that's the other thing, too. Like, the entire legacy of Star Wars is filled with missed opportunities. I know I've talked about this on the show before. I have no idea where, because we've never done a Star Wars movie, but I've definitely brought this story up. There is a moment in The Phantom Menace where I thought we were going to get one of those grand gestures that links everything together when Qui-Gon is separated by the force field.
Oh yeah.
In the fight with Darth Maul.
Great fight, by the way.
He meditates.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I thought for a moment what we were going to get was Liam Neeson raising his lightsaber the way that Alec Guinness does when he knows Darth Vader is about to strike him down, having the young Obi-Wan witness there. It, and then that makes his death a gesture of honoring his mentor and bringing the prequel back in line. Like, it would just instantly resonate through all of the stuff.
Yeah,
and Lucas just like, nah, they should fight more. Like, you can just feel him not see it.
That's interesting you say that. They still, in a sense, kind of got to that point, but not in an effective way like that.
I think single image would have seen
that would have been amazing. Like, in the story, it is Qui-Gon that teaches Obi-Wan how to become the Force Ghost. You should find that out in dialogue.
Right. Which is dumb.
But now I'm almost hoping that they make an Obi-Wan... Oh, by the way, Obi-Wan spinoff would be cool with Ewan McGregor coming back.
Yeah, even now, like, he's aging into it.
Kind of like a Logan-esque kind of movie. Like, you know, just kind of a... I mean, I would have to... Obi-Wan must be carrying a lot of weight on his shoulders.
He failed. He spent 30 years alone with his guilt, right?
His entire Jedi Order is dead. His Padawan's responsible for all this. Like, he's alone on this planet. Like, I actually want to know that story. Mm-hmm. There is no content filling really that gap. Maybe in some of the animated series. So that would be a great spinoff. Like, a really character. Yeah. Like, I loved Logan. Like, it's kind of a tough movie to watch, to be honest. It's quite mm-hmm. depressing. But it's like...
That's the Children of Men of the X-Men movie. Right?
Yeah, like, that's a great way to put it. But yeah, I would love to see that Obi-Wan movie and like how... Also, Ewan McGregor, obviously one of the best parts of the prequels.
Oh, yeah. He would be... My fear, actually, is that if they do another solo movie, now that they've established that they're both on Tatooine at the same time, they'll just cross paths. And that won't work.
No, it won't.
Because Han doesn't believe in magic and like...
They have to be careful to like not show him any of that stuff.
Exactly, that's the problem you have with these things. It's like, and this brings me back to the Lucas blind spot for his own canon. It happens in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, it happens in Raiders, but you know, in Raiders he has that speech about how he doesn't believe in any of this stuff, and it's the same kind of thing that Han said.
Uh-huh.
And then we find out in the next movie that a year earlier he used magic.
Oh,
with the Shankara stones, and you're just like, why would you? You know we pay attention. Guys, come on. And so you couldn't do it, but they're going to want to, especially since they've introduced Maul as the villain of this new trilogy that they were trying to set up.
Yeah, that...
It just seems like such a dumb idea.
That, to me, that note did not strike well for me.
Yeah, because I hadn't watched any of the animated stuff, and I had no idea he'd been resurrected.
Okay, so I haven't watched all of it, but I've seen clips and I was very familiar with the resurrection of Maul, mm-hmm. and I thought it was kind of fun to exist in that animated world, which, you know, I didn't think would ever cross over into the movies.
Yeah.
But when it actually happened, I was like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
You know, like, they're actually doing this.
It threw me right out. I'm like, wait a minute, what year is this? What's happening? He's dead!
And I don't know, like Darth Maul, seriously, is... probably the best part of Phantom Menace. I mean, like, just this silent
he's the most interesting
samurai.
Yeah, presence.
Right? Like, he's so interesting, and I just don't want to know more. I don't. Like, and then the way he, like, twirled his lightsaber in the hologram and Solo, I was like...
Just to make sure.
It's just, yeah.
Just in case, kids.
Hey, kids, like, this is that toy that you might remember.
Yeah. Remember how cool this was? It's still cool, right? That felt like Ron Howard to me. That just felt like somebody who's trying a little too hard to sell a point.
Yeah, I honestly, yeah, I can't even guess whose decision that was, but I just... Yeah,
it might have been Ray Park. He might have just wanted to do it again.
I love... It was him, right?
Yeah,
it was
yeah, same him? Actor, different voice, but same actor.
Yeah, it was the animated guy voice, who Sam Witwer. He's great though. I actually mm-hmm. like he does a great job in as Palpatine and Darth Maul in the animated series. But it's an interesting thing. There's a lot of choices that need to be made around these films now. They've grown to such a level that like not really any other franchise has. And there's so many cooks in the kitchen. There really are.
Well, that's it, right? It's got 40 years of history.
Yeah.
And
no consistent.
People who are willing to go in any direction because they've rationalized that it's possible.
Yeah. And Lucas, one thing I will say about the prequel trilogy, they are consistent.
Yep.
They're coherent with each other. They may not be fully coherent with the original trilogy, but the three movies it's definitely made by the same person.
Yeah, no, stylistically, tonally, I mean, the tech evolves, but
yeah,
the spirit is the same.
But that's one thing I felt quite jarring about The Last Jedi and the Force Awakens is that like I don't know it did feel like they're you can just by watching those films I can sense that there's like creative arguments going on in the upper rooms that like maybe they haven't actually settled on something but someone's calling the shots. I don't know. Like it just doesn't feel like someone actually planned this out, this new trilogy out.
Okay.
And that
I like the fact that the second one that Jedi Last Jedi feels like it's both Empire and Jedi and it just
they have the beats. You can rearrange the beats to make those two movies, yeah.
And killing off Snoke and just saying, you know what, this is a dumb idea, we're not going with it, here's the real menace. I like that. That's the shift in the second film where Vader, in Empire, where Vader comes into his own, but there's still the Empire to answer to in the next movie. I think I like the idea of throwing it all away being the theme of the latest film, of Rian Johnson just going for it and ending all of these key relationships and leaving everybody alone. Because that's how we felt at the end of Empire, is that, okay, Han and Leia are together, but now they're not. Leia and Luke aren't together, but now they are, physically in the same space, but they're not romantically linked. All the emotions are pointing in different directions, no one is together.
I also felt with the cliffhanger of Empire, though, is that like you want Luke and Leia to rejoin with Han and rescue Han.
Yeah.
Whereas you want with The Last Jedi, I felt that like Kylo has now kind of regressed back to who he was originally set out to be. Like that moment that he has when he kills Han Solo, he's just that guy again now. Like the Rey interference there and their connection, that was to me the most interesting part of the movie. But then when he kind of makes that choice to be the bad guy, and by the way, we already know kind of his cap, right?
Yeah.
We already know how his level, and that Rey is basically matched with him. So for me, the stakes just aren't there going into the next Star Wars. Whereas in Empire, again, like you have to rescue Han. Luke's arm is gone, and Vader's out there, and that there's this scary Emperor that we don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they did the Death Star thing over again in Jedi, which whatever. But
yeah, they've blown up the Death Star what, four times in all of these movies now, or three and a half, I guess.
I think, yeah. But.
It's a good goal.
With the new trilogy, I didn't get that many stakes from going into the next one. Obviously, The Last Jedi had like incredible dramatic moments that like shifted you in your seat physically. But I'm just interested to know like if they did have a plan like going into all these movies, because Marvel does a great job of this. Like I'm sure they have a big wall, the web, and like this movie connects to this movie at this point.
Sure, yeah.
Like I actually really enjoy the Marvel movies because it really feels like there's a unity in between them. But like you can still have a director put their stamp on it, right?
Sure,
like Taika Waititi can make Thor Ragnarok 3 and be totally different from the other two Thor movies, but I don't know.
Still maintain the spirit.
Still yeah. maintain. Yeah, I don't know. So I, we'll see. We'll see what happens with the last Star Wars, and that's why I was so interested to know kind of how you felt in that gap between Empire and Jedi.
Yeah, like, just excitement. Just, you know, there was going to be something else to watch. We, I mean, also when you're a kid, you have no idea of how the like the structure goes between. Empire and Jedi, we got Raiders, we got E.T., we got Poltergeist. It was a good few years to grow up. Star Trek 2 came out and actually fixed Star Trek in 82. There were movies to keep me busy. But, yeah, Star Wars was probably my first love, and I would always keep an eye on it. And then, of course, the power of marketing really, really kicked in between the two. And so there would be reissues, and there was a double bill at one point, maybe in 1982, where they both came back to the theater. And
oh, wow.
I'm pretty sure I went to that. Pretty sure. And it was just...
Because it was like an event, right?
Yeah,
it was.
I mean, it was unprecedented in terms of its appeal, but it was also the thing that felt magical every time you went back to it, because it was so completely different from anything else that you would just look at it. You could just... You know, I did it with Empire the last time. I just looked at the technology. I looked at the puppets. I looked at the sets. I looked at the toys and just thought, they really built everything. This is all engineered.
Yeah, I mean, even those AT-ATs, and like, this is so interesting. Like, they use stop motion to make those walk, but then they use high speed for anything when they ever like would fall or explode. Like they actually, again, Lucas was so interested in pushing technology. And it worked really well in that movie.
Yeah.
I think...
No, it all comes together. Every piece of it. I think it is still the pinnacle of Star Wars narrative storytelling.
Yes, for sure.
Because nobody knew what Star Wars was supposed to be, right? Like, there was no sense of an ossified
It helped
franchise.
It find its footing.
Yeah.
For sure.
They defined it rather than repeated it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, yeah.
That's what a sequel should do.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's what, yeah.
And now the idea of a sequel is to simply tell the same story again or continue it. You know, like the example I always bring up for a bad sequel is Die Hard 2, where it's almost good. Like, you can watch it and enjoy it, but you know it's not the first movie. What Empire does is completely different, right? I mean, it knows what you want. It gives it to you in the first act, and then it just denies it to you.
Yeah.
And makes you watch what else happens.
Yeah.
And it's better for it.
And it's so weird. I'm interested to hear your opinion on this, because you're a critic. Mm-hmm. But, like, I almost see Empire as flawless. Like, I
don't know what I would change about it, if that's what you mean.
Pacing
choices are strange, but it doesn't matter, because it moves. It finds its own rhythm in the second act, and the cross-cutting works. No, maybe the only thing I would change are I think they were called Ugnaughts, the little guys who bother C-3PO. Bounce his head around. That's just a bit silly.
Silly.
Because it sort of prefigures the Ewoks, and just, like, it's George Lucas
but
going,
they had Jawas in A New Hope, though.
Yeah.
So, like, I guess that's consistent I suppose with weird aliens in the universe.
Continuity.
My only thing, and it's kind of a funny thing, and you'll probably notice it next time you watch it, but, like, it's just when it's right after Lucas fought Vader, and he's in the ship, and he's kind of resting, and then Vader, you know, force calls him.
Right.
And he's like, Luke, and he's just like, Father? He's just immediately bought into it. Like, there's no skepticism. It's just like, he's immediately like, okay, Dad. Like, I just thought, like, that, him, just the way he reacted, that it always kind of makes me laugh. But
it's, now that you mention it, yeah, but it also, weirdly, it shores up the connection with Leia, doesn't it? Because if only blood can call blood, then you have this.
That's true.
Although that doesn't make sense with Kylo and...
Well, we don't know.
And Rey.
We don't fully know.
Yeah, but Snoke was behind that, right? Didn't he say he was doing it just to be a dick?
I don't know. I mean, like we have to... I guess we really have to wait to see how that all pans out and if anyone is related to anyone.
I like the idea that they're not. I mean, I love the idea that it's the same family is forced to go over this over and over again, that they're always going to be doing these things. You know, it's the Battlestar Galactica line, all this has happened before and all this will happen again. I like that because it feels... classical in its structure, but at the same time I love the idea that Rey is just from nowhere the way Luke was supposed to be. Like, originally our conception of him was that he was this lonely kid who wasn't connected to anything, and if that's her, then it then having him be her teacher fulfills that in a nice new way and lets it work differently.
Yeah, I think the only thing for me for the new trilogy to really satisfy me with that whole storyline and who's related to who, I'm totally fine with them being, you know, strangers. That's okay. Totally cool. I just think the way Rey is set up, especially with The Force Awakens, is like they're really teasing you as if she's someone.
I assume she was Luke's daughter. Yeah.
And also she's given qualities that are unprecedented. Like Luke, again, he had to kind of stumble his way through the Force. She's just kind of immediately an amazing pilot, which Anakin was.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so it really teases you. It's like, okay, she must have some sort of lineage to be this good. I think that the most like satisfying way to do it, that's like an evolution upon Star Wars and going in a new direction without having to be a family lineage thing, is that like if somehow her and Kylo were like these like poles of the Force, and like if because he's trained this much, she kind of gains more to balance him out.
Oh, I see.
Because it just doesn't ring true for me for her to like have all these. That's why I love Luke so much, because he's kind of a dope without his friends. He's just a guy who wants power converters on dusty Tatooine.
He has modest ambitions,
right? And like last year I really tried to like strike home that theme of failure, but it just didn't land for me because I feel like some of these characters are too perfect.
Yeah. I can sort of see that as an impediment. Yeah,
yeah,
but perfection's boring. So,
well, that's what I'm saying.
If you're going to tell more stories.
But that's what I'm saying, right? Yeah. Is that like, to have your kind of main character, if they're not related to the Skywalker blood.
To just have her be fully formed.
Yeah. What's the story behind that and why? And is there an interesting twist to it? And if we are evolving the Force, I think that'd be a really cool way to do it. Is to have her and Kylo be linked in such a way that, like, maybe they can't even kill each other. I don't know. Like, there's some sort of connection there. Like, so I hope that the next movie explores that and they don't kind of leave that unanswered, because I have a lot of questions why someone is that powerful. Because even Anakin, you know, who's apparently this Immaculate Conception,
yes,
Force baby. Yeah, he had, like, those pilot powers, but, like, he still had to train. Oh, that guy was fallible for sure.
Yeah.
Like, that guy made mistakes.
Yeah.
Right. So like, I don't know. Like, I definitely connect to Luke the most out of all the characters in the films, because I like someone who needs to kind of figure it out with friends and stuff. Rey definitely feels like a lone wolf, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know more about her, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, When I start talking Star Wars, I just can't.
Oh, no, it's great.
It's hard. I mean, obviously, again, Empire is my favorite, but it's hard not to view the entire universe as when you're talking about it. It's just they're so interwebbed and connected.
Yeah, no, how can it not be, right? I mean, it's also the first property that encourages us to do this, I think, in a way that, like, cinematically,
nobody
talked this way about the Bond films.
Right? Yeah.
And that's the only other thing I could think of that comes close to being culturally as unavoidable, maybe Planet of the Apes, but that was so niche in the 60s and 70s that, you know, nobody took it seriously, really, after the first one, and the world building was limited by the time travel stuff. The Star Wars, it inspired a level of conversation and nerdery that, you know, has now taken over the world.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yeah.
But here we are, like, debating incidental characters, spin-off movies, like, they could have their own show. Like, there is enough going on.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is because of Empire, specifically, because it is so vivid and alive in a way that nothing else had been. Like, Star Wars, I love Star Wars.
It's fun.
Yeah, but Empire is about stuff.
About stuff, yeah. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely feel the exact same way. Vivid, that's a good word.
Yeah, well, I've had time to think about it.
Yeah.
38 years. Jesus. But yeah, so this does sort of more or less lead to the closer question of the podcast, which is, what, if anything, of all the Star Wars films, but specifically Empire, I guess, have you borrowed or been inspired by or outright stolen or absorbed into your own creative DNA? Is there anything in Clara that links to it?
Yeah, they're actually, I mean, going back to just the, like, Luke Skywalker who needs his friends, I mean, you've seen the film, Clara, yeah. and the main character, he's fallible. He's definitely not a hero, and he's kind of on this road to discovery, a scientific discovery, because he's an astronomer, and you need all these other characters to kind of fill in these gaps. With Luke and Han and Leia and Chewie, I just love the fact, like, you don't go on adventures alone. And in the film, in Clara, you see this main character who is kind of closed off. He has to reach out to other people in his life, people from his past, to, you know, he needs help, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was, that's what I really love about Empire, is there's that speech that Yoda gives Luke about, like, if you go, like, you'll endanger your friends, kind of thing. And it's, I don't know, I feel like, you know, there is a price to pay with relationships. Like, you obviously do burden people with your problems, but if those people will, if they help you out, those are people that you want to support later on. And Luke goes and rescues Han in Return of the Jedi, you know, like, so for me, I Empire, what it does is solidify character relationships. And Clara, although it's a sci-fi, it's very much a drama. I mean, you know, making a sci-fi in Canadian film with a modest budget like that.
Right.
Like,
well, it's a conceptual science fiction film, right? I mean, it's about possibilities. It's,
yeah, I think, you know, as I'm growing as a filmmaker, I really like to start from a place of people and human relationships. As you know from the film, it's very woven around the main character's relationships to other people in the film and the past coming back. And Mark Hamill always, I think, he kind of quotes George Lucas, but the way he talks about Star Wars, he says it's a family matter. The episodes, at least. And I think to have that kind of human connection at the core of your film, to the backdrop of all the cosmic stuff, and you know, we were able to have some cosmic stuff in our film.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, practical effects, real stuff, all nice. All the space elements, all that stuff, are all from actual NASA images. So.
And they are gorgeous. It's just, there is something that element of the film, and of the fact that we are at this technological point now where you can actually see space, is just mind-boggling to me. Because in 1977, 1980, space was blurry video footage of the moon landing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we had no idea. And then that's the other thing that Star Wars did with John Dykstra's effects and what they built on top of those. You got to see the vastness. You got to understand. I'm probably wrong. I'm sure it happened. I must have seen something on TV before, but I like that tilt down in Empire to Hoth with the glow, the atmosphere, all of it. That was, I'm pretty sure, the first time I conceived of what a planet would look like from space that wasn't just a model on a stick.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of if Space Odyssey had anything that was kind of like that.
Jupiter, really. But Jupiter. It's presented in a different, you know, like, you don't see a thermosphere and an atmosphere.
Though, that glow.
I've never seen that before.
It felt, those shots hold up today so well.
Sure.
I don't know. There's just something of, just the craft of that. And going forward, I would love to. That interests me. Like I said, I started out in visual effects. I think, you know, the technological side of filmmaking, it's necessary, but it's really only there to kind of help your story. You know, if it becomes the focus for the future, you end up with Transformers and all this kind of cuttiness and, you know.
Yeah.
But what Empire does is it just elevates the story in a way that, like, it stamps those moments into your brain. But what we've been reacting to the most in this conversation is the story and those characters.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the people, whether human or otherwise,
they're
the reason you come back.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I like so much about the new films, is that the performances are allowed to be, like, idiosyncratic and strange and
weird. Adam Driver's so good.
Just realizing halfway through the second time I watched Force Awakens that Oscar Isaac, Poe Dameron, but that he just calls everybody buddy.
Hey, buddy.
It makes no sense, but, like, it's great. It's just a way of instantly establishing... I mean, that makes him the Han Solo in this movie, and that he's the charismatic wild card.
Yeah.
But he's just so companionable and warm. And then the more, you know, when they introduce him with that silly phone call prank in Last Jedi, it's delightful because you know who this guy is, even though he really hasn't done very much.
Yeah.
He led a couple of assaults, and he helps. He's a helper. But he's also got this weird, chaotic, good kind of presence.
And you kind of just know who that person is.
Yeah. And that lines him up to my mind with, you know, like Han Solo
and Orlando
in Star Wars. Orlando, and that they're both...
You just kind of know. You kind of get a sense of who this person is.
Yeah. Coming swindlers, but with warmth.
With warmth, yeah. Star Wars is all about warmth. Like, it really does... I don't know. It speaks to... Again, like that whole family connection thing. Like, I really feel that. And, a big part of my life. Made me want to be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's wonderful. And I really want to see your Boba Fett movie now, because it would have to be fun.
Yeah. No, I won't spoil it. I won't spoil it. There's some really fun set pieces. I'll send it to you sometime.
My thanks to Akash Sherman, whose first feature, Clara, has its world premiere at TIFF this afternoon, Monday, September 10th, at 5:30 p.m. at the Ryerson Theatre. It screens again at the Scotiabank Theatre at 9:30 p.m. on Thursday, September 13th, and if you go to one of those screenings, you will probably see friend of the show, Ennis Esmer, there. Say hi for me. Thanks also to Angie Power. She knows what she did. You can find Akash on Instagram at Akash Sherman, all one word, and you can follow his movie on Twitter and Instagram at Clara the Film, also all one word. And, of course, the Star Wars movies are available on Blu-ray and DVD from 20th Century Fox and Walt Disney Studios Home Entertainment, depending on which ones you're looking for, and on iTunes and Google Play. Except for Solo, which comes out on digital September 14th, and on 4K, Blu-ray, and DVD September 25th. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying the show, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. May the Force... you know.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.